This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. So here's some numbers for you. We're the seventh oldest state in the nation. The 65-plus population in Connecticut is projected to grow by 57% by the year 2040. And as we've heard before, if it wasn't for an influx of immigrants to our state, we'd be getting even older, even faster. But in a lot of ways, the Connecticut story is the story of America, and Europe for that matter. We're getting older. There are big questions about whether our systems can handle it. There's healthcare, of course, very important for a population that will need more medical care as it ages. But there's also the impact on our economy. Who replaces older workers leaving specialized fields? What happens with housing? There are even questions about the environmental impact of this silver tsunami. More on that later. Is Connecticut prepared to meet the needs of its aging population? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, at Where We Live. Joining us in studio today is Greg Bordenaro, who's editor of the Hartford Business Journal. They've got an ongoing series called Connecticut's Silver Tsunami. Greg, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Julie Evans-Starr is here as well, executive director of Connecticut's Legislative Commission on Aging. Julie, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here as well.
Good to be here, John.
Well, Greg, let's start with you. And first of all, why did you take this on at the Business Journal as a topic? What's so interesting to you about this aging population?
Well, we have these reader roundtables that we have when we invite business executives and business leaders in, and we have discussions on what are the major issues impacting them and their companies. And roundtable after roundtable and different business leader after different business leader raised the idea of a big threat to them and also the Connecticut economy was the state's aging population and what is the state's strategy for replacing aging workers. And more importantly to them, how are they going to replace their workforce as it ages and goes into retirement?
Maybe we'll talk about what that plan is in just a moment. But I gave some numbers at the top. And what are some other trends? What do the numbers show us here?
Well, like you said, Connecticut is the seventh oldest workforce. The average age, according to the 2011 census, was 40. That's probably trending higher at this point. In the next 10 years, 35% of the state's population will be age 55 and older. And the other concern is that the size of Connecticut's workforce is projected to shrink by about 3.3% in the next 15 years. And Don Klepper-Smith, who's a New Haven economist, he said that the non-working population and the working population will be almost equal over the next 15 years.
So talk a bit more about that. When you say the size of the workforce is shrinking, do we mean across the board in all sectors? Are some sectors of the workforce shrinking more rapidly than others?
Obviously, manufacturing has always been the trouble spot and the biggest concern. The average manufacturing employee age is in its 50s. That's the number one concern, and there's been a lot of effort to try to rectify that with apprenticeship programs and things like that. But you know, there's concerns about workforce shortages in a lot of industries: science, technology, engineering, math, and also the healthcare industry as well, with nurses and doctors.
Julia, I'll just turn to you quickly and say this is something we've talked about an awful lot on the program is younger people fleeing Connecticut. As you look at these numbers, I mean, what is this really all about? Is it about we're not having babies fast enough? We're aging and the younger people are moving out of the state? I mean, what are the trends that you're seeing that are worrisome here?
Well, we like to have this discussion in the context, and I think the Hartford Business Journal did a good job of this, of saying that there are challenges and there's also opportunities. And one of those opportunities, Greg had mentioned, replacing the aging workers. We think older adults are actually part of the solution. And you probably knew I was going to say that, right? Because people are living longer. We have the third oldest constituency in the country. And we know through some studies that have been done, they're quite entrepreneurial. And so we think that older adults are actually a part of the solution, and we should have strategies to help them stay in the workforce. So,
and talk a bit about that. I mean, what's the strategy there? If somebody's been working in manufacturing for, say, 25, 30, 40 years, and they get out of the workforce, I mean, they're not going to keep working in manufacturing. What are you talking about here?
Well, I think we're seeing a rise of some kind of new skills training and helping people stay engaged through some innovative programming. But I think the more important piece is really how we help folks do so. And it's so very important because if you think in terms of the wisdom that folks bring, the experience, so it might not be manufacturing. It might mean that they find their skills and do something else. They have more time. They might have more resources. And we really want to leverage their wisdom and what they have to bring to the table.
Greg, what did you find around this, around this notion that as workers age out of maybe the jobs they've been doing, there's something they can be retrained for? I mean, what do you see as the state's efforts at trying to deal with this?
Sure. And, just following up on that, our stories weren't all negative about this being a major problem for the state. There is a lot of opportunities to leverage the institutional knowledge that older workers have as they transition out of their, private sector jobs. The nonprofit sector, for example, is taking advantage of that. People who made a lot of money during their careers transitioning to nonprofit work to help them. So there are a lot of opportunities, and we highlighted some of that. In terms of the workforce development strategy of the state, there is no sort of blueprint, overarching strategy, but there are a lot of efforts both in the private and public sector to try to get a new workforce ready in line. Manufacturing, states spent millions of dollars on apprenticeship programs. The community colleges are ramping up their manufacturing programs. Goodwin College just opened up a new manufacturing facility in East Hartford. Astantuck Community College has a big manufacturing program. So there are a lot of efforts there. Obviously, the state has also invested a lot of money in bioscience and engineering and math programs at UConn. So there's efforts to ramp up that workforce as well. And in the private sector, there's a lot of examples within the corporations, them having mentoring programs and things like that in order to recruit younger workers.
So it does sound, from what Greg's talking about, that there are a lot of things that are happening right now at the state. Anything else you want to pick up on there?
Well, that's wonderful, and I'm glad that they're shining light on it. The one thing I would like to pick up on is kind of the other side of the coin, and where we started is the fastest growing job is actually going to be for direct care workers. So PCAs, home health aides, the people who provide care for people who are older in need of long-term services and supports. And so there's a great deal of work that needs to be done to bring value and really build that workforce.
I'd like to talk about one of the things that you highlighted, Greg, though, that's really important, the impact on small businesses in the state. There's an awful lot of small businesses that are family-owned, and we've been hearing about this as a trend nationwide for years, which is a lot of times the kids and the grandkids don't want to get into the family business, and then what happens?
Sure. Well, we highlighted a study that found up to 85% of small and medium-sized businesses in Connecticut don't have a succession plan in place, which means when their owners die or get to a point where they can't run the company, they don't know where to turn or what next step to do. So one of the big concerns in Connecticut is that you're going to have all these companies going on the market at once and no buyers, or you're going to have out-of-state buyers come in and buy our Connecticut-grown companies and maybe shift jobs out of Connecticut. So there is a big void in terms of small businesses having a strategy and what they're going to do once the owners retire.
Well, what do you think all this means for the state's economy moving forward, Greg? Because obviously we've been mired in this very slow economic growth, a bit slower to come out of the recession than some other states. Are the long-term trends, from what you hear from economists, are they dire for the state, or are there some things that are optimistic on the horizon here around these issues?
I mean, I don't know if I'd call it dire, but people, young workers flock to cities and states where there's high growth rates, where they could find good jobs and see their long-term careers going. So that's, I think, the challenge for Connecticut. Also, the aging population poses problems with the state finances. Connecticut's unfunded pension liabilities are among the highest in the country. And as more people retire and the workforce shrinks, you're going to have fewer taxpayers paying for these long-term obligations. So that could exacerbate the state's finances even worse.
We're talking with Greg Bordenaro, who's editor of the Hartford Business Journal. They've got a series called Connecticut's Silver Tsunami. It's about our aging population and what's being done to solve some of these issues. Julia Evans Starr follows these issues closely. She's executive director of Connecticut's Legislative Commission on Aging. I want to welcome in Dr. Lisa Walk, who's clinical chief of geriatrics at Yale School of Medicine. Doctor, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So you've been hearing a little bit of this conversation. I guess I'm just wondering, as we look at these numbers broadly before we dig into some of the specifics, what is it you see when you hear about a rapidly aging population, a lot of young people moving away, maybe not the replacement workers in some key jobs? What are the top things from your standpoint that you want to raise to our audience?
Well, Well, certainly we've known in geriatrics that the aging of our society was going to be happening for a number of years, and we've been planning for it. I think now other people realize as well and are trying to focus. From our point of view in healthcare, we're trying to look at extending the healthcare workforce of those who are equipped to take care of older adults. So extending beyond physicians and nurses, the traditional kind of focus, to include all healthcare workers and also non-healthcare workers, so unpaid professionals, family members and such who are caring for older adults, to get everyone equipped to care for older individuals.
Well, one thing that's interesting, though, about the workforce is let's say we move more people into healthcare fields to deal with this aging population. This is going to be jobs for people, and it's also going to be providing a service that we're going to need. That does, I think, mean probably there's going to be people not doing other stuff, right? I mean, the people are going to be moving away from some field into the field of healthcare, maybe leaving some of their holes.
Certainly, that's a possibility. And we do need more workers, though. So clearly, it's not to say that a field that is overpopulated. We need to have more individuals there. But it might be that we need to do other things smarter, perhaps, or more efficient if people are going into healthcare.
Do you take my point, Julie? I mean, at the end of the day, we only have so many people who are going to be gainfully employed working at things. We've already seen this explosion in the medical field, the medical device field, and biotechnology. There's more hospitals and hospital groups caring for people across our state than I've ever seen before. As we move more people into this field, it seems as though while that sector grows, a lot of other things may have to be in decline.
That may be true. And I guess what I'd really like to address is the issue that Greg mentioned specific to younger folks leaving, right? And they're the workforce issues. And we know if somebody's going to age well, what we really need to do is have our public policies, our social infrastructure, and our community conditions be prepared for that. And I think that's really the discussion, because the conversation of where the jobs go, who's going to flock to these jobs, regardless of age, really necessitates making Connecticut and its communities a place where people want to live.
Yeah, Greg, you want to pick up on that? Because obviously making Connecticut a place where people want to live is a big part of growing the business community in the economy of the state.
Sure. And, you know, one of the interesting things is obviously the economic growth in Connecticut has been slower than the rest of the nation coming out of the recession. But the Department of Labor just put out a report, so there's 40,000 job vacancies in the state. So there are jobs available, but we don't have the right workers to fill those jobs. And that's sort of – I think that underscores the issue of an aging population.
You talked about this before, though, with some of the training programs at the community colleges, et cetera. We've been hearing about a misalignment of the workforce for some years. Does it feel like it's getting in a better direction where we're actually starting to train people for the jobs that are open that need to be done in the state?
I think we are getting definitely better at that, especially with the manufacturing. There are a lot of different apprenticeship programs out there now. You know, one of the things the manufacturing industry is trying to do is trying to change the perception of people not wanting to go into manufacturing because they see these – they think of it as, you know, these dungy little backroom manufacturing where you're going to be, you know, getting dirty all day. But, you know, Connecticut is advanced manufacturing. It's not what it used to be. And so I think they're not only trying to train people, but they're also trying to shift the perception of the industry, which is key to recruiting more people to that industry. And I think the investment in bioscience and science, technology, engineering, math, those are probably the industries we want to be in. Whether these investments are the right or wrong, I'm not going to judge that at this point. But those are certainly the high-demand jobs, and that's where the growth could come in the future.
This conversation is happening at an interesting time, of course, because aging workforces are not just an issue here in America. They're increasingly an issue in Europe. One argument is about the current influx of migrants arriving in Europe. It could be a good thing for countries with aging workforces there. Here's The Economist's Oliver August in an interview with NPR host Steve Inskeep.
They're a problem and an opportunity, I would say. They're a problem when they arrive on your doorstep, as any unannounced guest would be. They need feeding and housing. That's not immediately available. But I think Europe is a grown-up place with many resources that should be able to deal with this relatively easily. And beyond that, they're a phenomenal opportunity. Here are people who have shown their great mettle by making it this far, who are highly motivated and grateful to be here, who in many cases are educated and have skills that are useful, coming to a continent that is rapidly depopulating, where lots of places lack nurses and engineers and doctors, And a lot of these people could quite easily be assimilated, I would argue, into our societies and make an extremely valuable contribution.
So that's Oliver August talking to Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition about migrants coming from war-torn Syria into Europe, potentially being seen as, Julia, an opportunity in that rapidly aging continent. I think an awful lot of what we're hearing there is part of the Connecticut story as well. I said off the top, and we've been saying this for years, if we didn't have immigration in our state, we would be getting even older, even faster, and losing population. But immigrants have helped to stanch some of this and helped to replace people in the workforce.
That's absolutely true. So we were talking about the need to have direct care workers, home health aides, and we know in Connecticut alone that immigrants comprise of 28% of that workforce. So it's really critical in helping provide that kind of care.
Can you pick up on that, Liz?
Yes, absolutely. And as you're saying, we need to have more workers. And so as Greg was mentioning, the perceptions of manufacturing is similar, changing the perception of what a healthcare provider is and the types of needs that we have for our older adults. So absolutely, immigrants, other people who are here that maybe weren't filling jobs, some of those open vacancies, if now they can get into the healthcare field, that's a benefit to us.
And if you look at a lot of the large insurance companies in Hartford, you know, they the visa programs, they fill a lot of positions. People from India and other parts of the country, they already fill a lot of positions at these companies. So immigration is definitely a key issue. And it's certainly a part of the solution, I think, for Connecticut's workforce.
But
go ahead.
I'm sorry. I had an additional point. But not only the workers need to be diverse, but because we know our population is as well. So it's helpful to have a diverse workforce who are also caring for a diverse population within the state.
Cultural sensitivities, there's an awful lot to that when you're talking about caring for an aging population. If you have people who have language and cultural sensitivities, that's really important. It's something I know people have found over the years, Lisa.
Absolutely. So to be able to communicate in someone's primary language is definitely a benefit, but also to understand the culture and the background where that individual came from. As you get older, that's perhaps even more important to you. And so to be able to have someone who can relate in that manner is beneficial.
Before we take a break, I really want to get to this question of people staying engaged. There's an awful lot of things about the economy that are impacted by an aging workforce, but there's some just real things about civic connectedness when you have people who are deciding to get out of the workforce. Maybe they're staying around here. Maybe they don't stay as connected to their communities. Sometimes older people vote much more readily than younger people. But I guess, Lisa, if you can talk about that, about the importance of people staying involved as they get older and what that could mean for holding together some of the social fabric of the state.
Absolutely. So most older adults want to continue to contribute. So if you're not contributing in the workforce per se, you want to contribute in other manners. And so to be able to volunteer, to be engaged in civil activities, as you mentioned, voting, not only just to be a voter, but to work in the voting polls. You often notice is oftentimes older adults who are doing that, working in our schools. And so there are a lot of opportunities for older adults to be engaged and to contribute to our society in meaningful ways.
And some of that involves flexible models. So we know people, older adults, want to give back, but we also know the economy's changed and maybe they have less savings. So we need to create some innovative models that support people, maybe give them a stipend, maybe some income. So we need to kind of rethink what retirement is and what those contributions look like and how it benefits the older adult as well as the community.
And one of the programs that we highlighted was Leadership Greater Hartford's Third Age Initiative, where they take people who are in retirement and train them either in a new job, if they're looking for a new job, or train them, give them leadership skills to help lead nonprofits and things like that.
And as a geriatrician, we encourage our older adults to remain active. So we're encouraging people to stay active cognitively for the benefits it improves for your health.
We're talking with Dr. Lisa Walk, who's clinical chief of geriatrics at the Yale School of Medicine, also Julia Evans Starr, who's executive director of Connecticut's Legislative Commission on Aging. I want to thank Greg Bordenaro, who's editor of the Hartford Business Journal. His series, Connecticut's Silver Tsunami, running in the Business Journal, got us thinking about this issue. And Greg, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Again, we'll have links to some of these stories on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, wnpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the impacts of a rapidly aging population on our state with Julia Evans Starr, Executive Director of Connecticut's Legislative Commission on Aging, and Dr. Lisa Walk, who's Clinical Chief of Geriatrics at the Yale School of Medicine. We'd like to hear from you at 860-275-7266. We'll get to some of your calls in a moment. Are you newly retired or out of the workforce? Are you finding it hard to stay in Connecticut as you retire? Some of the questions that we'll answer. One of the things that Julia talked about a bit in the first segment, Lisa, that I'd like to hear you chime in on is, do we have a healthcare system that is ready to handle our growing aging population?
We're developing one.
You're both so very optimistic.
Yes.
Of course. I think that's why we're in this field.
Exactly.
Are we there yet? No. But we do recognize that we need to get there. And I think perhaps, as Julia mentioned before, we're initiating new programs and trying to encourage individuals who perhaps had a career in something other than healthcare, who are now retired, perhaps have more time, could be part of our volunteer services, could do other things auxiliary and within the healthcare system. So we are definitely working towards getting a more diverse workforce that includes workers, individuals rather, at all ages.
You know, one of the things that we've heard for years as we have more healthcare needs in America is we're just not turning out enough primary care doctors. I mean, you just don't have enough people to fill the demand, certainly after Obamacare puts all these new patients into the system. We just don't have enough doctors willing to get into that. How about the field of geriatrics? We've got this rapidly aging population. Is this a field that has the replacement workers it needs?
No. There should be people banging at the doors right now. Unfortunately, we don't have that in geriatrics. There has been a greater recognition, though, that we need to have more healthcare professionals in all fields who have understanding of geriatric principles and how to take care of older adults. And so there are initiatives, federal initiatives. HRSA, the Health Resources Service Administration, recently came out with a geriatric workforce enhancement program that's an award nationwide to encourage applicants to come up with ways of integrating geriatrics and primary care, recognizing that we do not have enough geriatric healthcare professionals, so we need to have our primary care providers interested and informed about geriatric principles, and also to expand the geriatric workforce by looking at all healthcare professionals and direct care workers, family members, caregivers as individuals to increase the geriatric workforce.
I just want to say, and I don't want to always be bucket of cold water guy, this sort of my job here a lot of times is, I think that this grant, this federal grant to the state, I'm reading here, a grant of $833,000 will help fund the Connecticut Older Adult Collaboration for Health. It's a partnership between Yale School of Medicine, Yale School of Nursing, Yale New Haven Health System, Cornell Scott, da, 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 and goes on and on and on. So it's $833,000 to do an awful lot of work. That's help, but that's probably not the help at the level we need given the massive problems that we have to face.
So just to clarify, as the project director for this, so the collaboration, as you mentioned, the other collaborators, Cornell Scott, Hill Health, Community Center, Fairhaven Community Center, Gateway Community College. So it's $833,000 for this first year. It's a three-year grant, so total comes out to be about $2.5 million. And certainly there's a lot more that we need, but it's mm-hmm. definitely a beginning. And what we're doing is leveraging our support with our collaborators as well as our community-based organizations that we're working with. What are the strengths that we all currently have so we're not duplicating efforts? Can we expand our field by collaborating together and joining forces? So this award allows us to form that collaboration to partner amongst ourselves but also with our community providers, and certainly we're looking to magnify the benefits of the award that they give us. So that's a start to get us on this project, but it's not the sum total of the support.
Of everything else. Could you just talk about that quickly, Julia, about the need for more workers getting into this field, the need for just more attention at the state or the federal level on dealing with an aging population?
Right. So one of the good things we have going on, you won't need to throw cold water on me, is that we have this huge movement we've talked about in the past to help people stay in their homes and communities. And when we talk about healthcare, there are other models and other trends that are kind of influencing cost savings. So we know people want to stay in their homes and communities. We know it saves the state and folks money. We know it's actually a right under the U.S. Supreme Court Olmstead decision. And so the federal government and the state are working in partnership with a lot of opportunities. And one of those is a $225 $5 million incentive grant. So Connecticut creates a space where people can stay in their home and communities. And there's a tremendous amount of work being done. And under that is workforce development. So to the extent there's acknowledgement, and you had mentioned this earlier, that people want to stay in their homes and communities, but they to make that a reality, we need to create an infrastructure, whether it's transportation, housing, you name it, that supports folks and keeps them connected. We have this movement we call rebalancing, where part of the actual program transitions people from nursing homes into the community. But if you're moving them from one place of isolation to another, you've really done very little. So
this idea of keeping – go ahead. I want you to pick up on that. But I'd like to hear more about keeping people in their homes. Yeah.
Well, so I was going to tie into that. Yeah. So recognizing, as Julia mentioned, that people do want to stay in their homes. One of the programs that we recently started at Yale was a home visit program, recognizing mm-hmm. that some people are unable to get out from their homes to see their providers. And then sometimes the only health care they get is coming into the emergency room or the hospital. And certainly we want to offer another opportunity instead of that being the only level that you can get care. So going along with supporting people in their homes. But it's our program is a geriatrician and a geriatric care coordinator. And a lot of that is trying to make sure they're connected to these services that you mentioned that will provide transportation. What services will come to your home? Do you need to have groceries delivered? Do you other things? It's not just being able to live in your home, but you need to be able to live well in your home.
Right.
So,
and that means not necessarily just having people bring you things or give you care. It means being able to get out and get some transportation that actually makes sense. I think another thing, which is maybe a bigger holistic change, is, you know, in a lot of people's homes, they've had these homes for some time. Maybe they grew up in them. Now they have them. And, you know, they're paid off. But the taxes are killing them. They have to leave their homes or they have to worry about how they're going to stay in their homes because they're paying increasingly higher property taxes on these properties.
Absolutely. And so I think some people have learned to be creative along those lines. So sometimes, depending on where you are, come near to a community. Obviously, I'm at an academic institution. People sometimes rent rooms to younger adults who don't have a lot of finances but don't want to live on campus, let's say. And so there are ways that older adults sometimes are creative. When we talked before about having students or having people come from other places, there are often a lot of students who come here for at least come to Yale for rotations and such that aren't from the United States. They're looking for some place to live for a month or 2 months or 3 months. Sometimes some older adults have become creative to realize that they can have that situation where they can offer some of their housing. So that helps them pay their taxes, remain in their house, and it's also a benefit to the student who's coming from out of town.
And if I could go a little further, I've been doing this work for 21 years, and we used to always say people want to stay in their homes and communities. We were we would always emphasize the home. But as you say, the home might not be the most practical decision for somebody. So at times you can use creative thinking and bring students in or whatever you think is best for you. But other times the best decision might be to sell your home. You can actually stay in your community, but your home might not be the best place for you.
Well, one of the things we've talked about a lot on the program, though, is the availability or not of affordable housing for rental or for buying the property in the state. And this is a big problem here. I mean, do we have the housing stock that supports people maybe getting out of their original home, but not into a nursing home or even some sort of 55 and over community, but something that they can afford?
You have hit the nail on the head. That is been proven to be the biggest barrier in keeping people in their homes and communities. Do we have affordable, accessible housing? And there's a growing recognition that we do not, and we need to make a commitment from a state level to rectify this. And we're hearing that out of the Department of Housing and others. So there is awareness, at least.
Yeah, I definitely would echo that. Obviously, if people can't afford where they're living or it's unsafe for them to stay there and they need to live someplace that's more manageable, it also has to be affordable for them. We don't want people using all their life savings then to just for day-to-day activities kind of maintain, and they're concerned that they won't have enough. They'll outlive their savings during their retirement period. So that's certainly a concern that we find with older adults.
Are you finding that people are retiring earlier, they're retiring quite a bit later? I mean, what are people doing around retirement right now across our state and across the nation?
So I don't have actual numbers. Based on my experience, I would say that people tend to retire a little bit later. I think before we considered 62, certainly 65, people were trying to get out of the workforce. And now I have patients who are well into their 80s who are still working and enjoying what they're doing. Sometimes it's a second career. Sometimes it's continuation of what they were doing before. So I do think that people have come up with a different mindset. It's not that, oh, boom, I turned 65, I have to retire. They recognize I'm still young, I'm healthy, I'm doing things I like to do. I want to continue to do this job or contribute in this manner. So I think that people are rethinking that age of when it's time to retire.
And what do we know about that around the numbers, Julia? Because I think that obviously as people do retire later, they're remaining in the workforce sometimes to, I think as Lisa said, into their 70s and 80s. That can pose its own challenges as well. I mean, what do we know about retirement age and where that sits in our state right now?
Right. I mean, people are working longer. Sometimes, unfortunately, it's not their choice. And we do know research would show specific to Connecticut that once folks lose their job who are older, they have a much more difficult time getting reemployment. So there's a remarkable work that needs to be done for that particular group of people that want to stay engaged.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. And we'll get to some of your phone calls in just a moment. I think... Before we end the segment, I'd just like to hear from you, Doctor, about what people can do if they want to help in some way. We were talking a little bit earlier about getting older people in Connecticut involved in volunteering opportunities and staying active. But what if people want to, in some ways, help elderly people, aging people? They know a lot of people in their community. What are some best ways to reach out and actually help?
Yeah, there are a lot of opportunities, both in volunteer opportunities. So people aren't necessarily looking for engagement, employment rather. So hospitals oftentimes are looking for volunteers. I know Area Agency on Aging are looking for older adults to be companions with other older adults. And as we were talking before, having those cultural similarities, perhaps experiences, that's a benefit if you're able to help somebody else. There are senior corps, and so we often know about the National Health Corps. There's a senior corps that does a lot of volunteer opportunities. So there are a lot of opportunities that people are interested in that manner. There are probably other things that aren't perhaps as formalized. Schools are often looking for volunteers to help with their students with reading, with homework and such. There are volunteer organizations we know well-established in our state, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and Boys and Girls Clubs, things like that, who are looking for volunteers, and as an older adult, they have a wealth of information, wealth of experience to be able to share with a younger generation. Keeps the people engaged.
I think one thing, Julie, that I've been thinking a lot about is we are living so much longer as a society than we used to. I remember as a child working with my grandmother at Meals on Wheels.
Yes.
And she was in her 60s, and I thought she was an old lady. And she was taking care of people who were quite a bit older than her at the time. And that entire program in the East Hills of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, was really run by women in their 60s and 70s for people in their 80s and 90s. And I think that increasingly there's probably even more of a place for that right now because there's more people in their 80s and 90s and there's a lot more active people who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who can help.
That's right. That's so interesting that that's your memory. I have the same memory of my grandfather, who I guess was in his late 60s, who seemed quite old to me, and we were delivering meals as well somewhere in Indiana. So, and that's actually part of the story that got me to do this work is just that remarkable experience of being with him and meeting people. But yeah, I mean, when you look at the generations, we talk about the projections. You know, we're looking at from 2025 or 2040. Who are we talking about here? If you make the projections that the you had said it at the top of the program, between 2010 and 2040, the 65-plus population is going to increase by 57%. 2040. Who are we talking about? We're talking about you.
We're talking about me.
Not me yet.
We are talking about me.
Years,
me
talk. No, so aging is an issue for all of us. And we're all, you know, you mentioned your grandmother at the age of 60. We're all of us just experiencing life through differing abilities. Right. So age is just a number.
Yeah. Maybe you could finish up on that point, Lisa, because I think age is just the number and there's a lot. in statistics like this, when we call it, as in Greg's piece in the Hartford Business Journal, a silver tsunami washing over us. And it's this, well, you can look at it as a problem, but I mean, there's an awful lot of, as Julie would say earlier, opportunities in here. And I'm sure that you see an awful lot, a lot of opportunities in this aging population.
Absolutely. So as I mentioned just before, there's a lot of experience that older adults have, their wealth of life experiences to be able also to share. And so we don't want to lose that in terms of lessons learned over life. That's one of the reasons why I went into geriatrics, was just interacting with older adults who wanted to share what they had learned so that I didn't repeat some of their same mistakes and just have the appropriate balance in my life. And so I thought that was really important. So I think there are great opportunities for older adults. And as we view aging differently, hopefully in our society, both in Connecticut but nationally, as not someone who's just in a rocking chair kind of off on the patio, but engaged in doing things and contributing in meaningful ways to our society, most of the citizens will also pick up on that and start to continue to engage in activities.
Oh, before we take a break, I should quickly get to a phone call here from Valentine in Hartford. Hi, Valentine. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. My question is, why does everybody refer to people over a certain age as older adults, like adults born before 1930 or over 75? Is that because we might confuse them with adolescents born before 1930 or children over 75? They're adults. You don't call yourself adult journalists. You're just journalists. So why don't we just say older people?
Oh, you want to use the word older people as opposed to older adults, Valentine?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, I take your point. I thank you very much. She raises a question about language, which I think our listeners tend to do quite a bit.
Well, it's interesting because they've done numerous studies on what people like to be called, and there is no uniform language. So some people, as Julia said, perhaps prefer older adults. Some people like, older people. Some people like older adults. No one seems to like the term geriatric or aging. So
I particularly don't like our seniors.
Yes. So I think
when I avoid it all
costs.
How
about elders? Do we like elders?
It depends on cultural background. So in some cultures, being an elder is well-respected, tends not to have the same recognition in the United States, but yes.
Okay. Because I'm, I do the radio. I'm always looking for the right words to say about these things. I want to thank Dr. Lisa Walk, who's Clinical Chief of Geriatrics at the Yale School of Medicine. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to Julia Evans-Starr, Executive Director of Connecticut's Legislative Commission on Aging. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
When we come back, we're going to talk about something very interesting that may happen because of this aging population, and it has to do with our ecology, about our forested land. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Usually, if there is an election day, it's on a Tuesday, and we'd be able to report on the results of that election day on Wednesday's Wheelhouse. Tomorrow, however, Wednesday, is actually primary day across the state for some reason. We'll probably be talking about that with Denise Merrill, the Secretary of the State, who oversees elections. We're also going to be talking about the big primaries happening in Hartford and Bridgeport and in New London. It's part of 2 days of primary coverage here on Where We Live. Hope you can join us tomorrow. Today we're talking about Connecticut's rapidly aging populations. We've been looking at some of the pluses, maybe some of the minuses, the challenges that we face. One of them is something very interesting to us. Mary Terrell joins us. She's Executive Director of the Global Institute of Sustainable Forestry at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Her report, Understanding Connecticut Woodland Owners, was done in collaboration with the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection's Forestry Division. Mary, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's really wonderful to be here.
So this is one of the issues that I guess I didn't think that we'd be talking about when we're talking about a rapidly aging population, its impact on our environment. Tell us how you got involved in this interesting issue.
Well, part of my work is studying private lands conservation and ownership throughout the United States. And here in Connecticut, 73% of our forest land is privately owned. So it's a huge impact. These landowners have a huge impact on the landscape in Connecticut.
The 73%, it's not just necessarily individuals, it's land trusts, forests and parks. But again, this is a lot of privately owned land.
It is. A good 50% of that is owned by families and individuals. So it's highly individualistic in terms of what they do with their land, but they all share a tremendous love of the land and a particular advocacy for the lifestyle. They just love living in the woods. A lot of them are very active on their land, and they're extremely attached to it.
And an awful lot of these people you found are actually over the age of 50.
Yes, 85% are over the age of 50.
Wow, so 85%. So what does that tell you? I mean, as we look at the long-term potential environmental impact on the state, what are some things you're divining from all this?
Well, one of the things we found was that a huge number of them are very concerned about how they can keep their land intact and pass it on to their heirs. It's something topmost on their mind. It's one of their biggest concerns. The other thing is that when we ask whether they would sell their land, anywhere between 200,000 and 300,000 acres could be in play.
Wow. So that's an awful lot of land in the state.
It's huge. It's huge. And it's a big concern to all of us. I think one of the reasons that probably maybe the primary reason people would want to sell is because they are getting older. And it's much more difficult for them to take care of their land. This is what we hear from folks who we did focus groups with in Connecticut, that they're used to managing the land themselves. They take care of it. And as they get older, that's much more difficult to do.
A lot of it's managing the land themselves, although we often see when there's a big tract of land that's sold for development, it's because there's a buck to be made. Earlier, we were talking about the fact that, you know, if you have a house and property, you're sometimes paying exorbitantly higher taxes than you were paying 10, 15, certainly 30 years ago. So cashing it in to a developer wants to put a bunch of houses on it maybe doesn't sound like such a bad idea.
Well, that's also true. That's part of it. There are some people who certainly that would appeal to, especially if they're thinking they want to retire. They need the income. Maybe that's going to be their retirement package.
Well, are we as a state looking into this issue enough so that we can actually help to, you know, stop some of this problem? We've been saying for years that, you know, we're a wonderfully forested land here in Connecticut. We have preserved so much open space over the course of the last several decades. Do you think that the state is doing what it needs to do to actually maintain some of this land in the face of just these demographics?
Well, I think there are two things to talk about here. One is the taxes, which you brought up, and the biggest concern people have is the high property taxes. However, Connecticut has a really terrific law, PA 490, which if you agree to keep your land in open space, either forest, farm, or open space for 10 years and not develop it, then you get a significantly reduced assessment value. So basically, it's taking away the development value of the land when you pay your taxes. And we found that the people who are in this program, almost 100% of them said this is absolutely essential for them being able to keep their land. They would not be able to keep it if they had to pay the standard highest and best use value property taxes. You have to have at least 25 acres, so not everybody can qualify. And surprisingly, not everybody is aware of this either. So I think the state's doing a great job in having this law on the books and in place. I think that perhaps a little more work could be done on awareness so that people who are eligible could actually be in the program.
25 acres seems like a pretty high threshold in such a densely populated state.
It is. It is. So it would be one big plus would be if we could bring it down to a lower threshold. I mean, other states have 10-acre thresholds, for example.
Well, you mentioned other states. I mean, are there other states that are really tackling this problem head-on in a better way than Connecticut is?
Oh, I wouldn't say so. I think all states are struggling with this. I mean, we do work all over the country, and yeah, I wouldn't say that there's any place that I've seen that's doing a better job necessarily.
Really? That's really interesting. So what about the role of land trusts? This is something we've talked about on the program before. Land trusts have enabled an awful lot of communities to preserve open space over the course of years. Are land trusts part of the equation here to help preserve this property?
Absolutely. Land trusts are extremely active in Connecticut. It's almost a joke. We have almost as many land trusts as we have towns. And some people think, well, that's inefficient. But in fact, it means that people are very aware of conservation options. And land trusts also play a big role in educational programs for landowners. So I think it's hugely important in the land trust community, both for preserving the land and also helping to educate landowners on what their options are and how they might take care of their land. The other thing that land trusts, I think we could make better use of land trusts in the educational end of things, because the second problem besides taxes is that people need help taking care of the land as they get older. And We in Connecticut have two service foresters. Those are people who are actually – their job is to help these private family landowners take care of their land. That's two people for – you know, if you look at the folks who own 10 or more acres, we have 17,000 landowners. So that's, you know, really – really too little. When you add in the Natural Resource Conservation Service folks and the Yukon Extension people, you have another handful. So I think that, first of all, I'd love to see more resources go into service providers for landowners at the state level. But also I think they can there can be a more innovative way of involving land trusts through some kind of small grants process where they have funds that they can use, because they're mostly volunteer organizations, right? So they don't have a lot of money. But if there could be some program where they could be have some incentives to work with landowners on how to manage their land, I think that would be a big plus.
If you want to take a slightly different look at this, if you want to go to our website, WNPR.org right now, you can find a story by our science reporter, Patrick Scahill, who's been reporting on the decline of the eastern cottontail in this area. Actually, it's a type of rabbit that thrives on certain habitats. Often when fields and areas like that become overly wooded, the rabbits go away. Well, there are some programs actually to try to help older landowners like the one that he profiles to maintain their land for certain habitat. That's at WNPR.org right now. I want to go to John, who's calling from Litchfield. Hi there, John. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. The question that I have is why, if Connecticut seems to be caring about keeping their seniors and worrying about the seniors, do they make it so expensive to stay in here as a senior and to die as a senior? We now have the highest cost of death in terms of probate and estate taxes of any of the states. And for people who might want to spend a couple of months in Florida over the winter or in some place warm, it behooves you to go actually and become a resident so you don't pay taxes and you don't pay estate taxes. This is ridiculous. You're driving seniors out of the state of Connecticut and having them spend their money someplace else and lowering the cost of real estate.
John, thank you very much for your phone call. I may just invite Julie Evans Starr to come back up to the microphone if I could, just because it's an issue actually that we hear an awful lot about. It's this notion that the state, because of taxes, because of regulations, for one reason or another, driving people out of the state, including elderly people. Do you hear some of the concerns from other people other than John in Litchfield?
We have heard some of those concerns, and we're very mindful of those when we identify public policies that are good for all ages as we move forward. So it's not that it's falling on deaf ears. We've definitely heard it. And we're also very clear that we have a fairly high quality of life here as well. So it's somewhat of a delicate balance to strike. But I'm empathetic and we're aware, and we do look to other states to perhaps show us new ways and cost-saving measures. And one of those ways, as we discussed earlier, was this whole rebalancing movement for healthcare and ways you can save money. So there is some creative thinking being done, and we hear it.
When you say other states, what other states are you looking at? I'm always interested in benchmarking against other states that are doing well along these lines.
Right. Well, specific to high quality of life and the helping people stay in their homes and communities and the work that we've been doing in that area, Oregon has been long a model and a mentor for Connecticut.
We hear about people retiring to Oregon. It's not necessarily a warm place to go, but we've been hearing about this for years.
Right. But I do think in many regards Connecticut is catching up. And on the other side of the coin, I think we need to do more to promote Connecticut and its natural resource and all that it has to offer. So if there are ways that we can increase revenue for Connecticut, I think that's an important strategy.
And Marion, just the last minute or so that we have, I think that's an important thing. This quality of life, the way that Connecticut looks, it feels, maintaining this quality of life is really a big part of what you're looking at here, right? We are a state that's a beautiful place to live, that's heavily forested, it has a lot of open space, and maintaining that actually should be one of the draws to keep people like John and Litchfield here.
It absolutely is. I mean, the character of this state completely depends on its forests and depends on the forest being healthy. And that's another concern I have for these older landowners is that if mostly what they'll do is just leave, let things alone, you know, let nature take its course. And we have a lot of forest health problems both here already and coming at us. And I think that without good advice and help for managing their land, that the forest health problems are going to become worse.
Could you say what a forest health problem might be?
Well, insects, invasive plants are a huge problem in Connecticut. We have several insects that are really decimating some of our trees. The emerald ash borer is killing ash trees. The hemlock woolly adelgid has pretty much killed most of the hemlocks in Connecticut. And we have Asian longhorn beetle, which has a wider appetite, which is in Worcester County, Massachusetts. So, you know, right on our border, and the U.S. government is got an all-out attack on Asian longhorn beetle. Well, hopefully they'll succeed, but if they don't, we're going to have that problem too.
Mary Tyrrell is Executive Director of the Global Institute of Sustainable Forestry at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. We've been looking at her report, Understanding Connecticut Woodland Owners. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Our program today produced by Lydia Brown with Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalea. Kyun Wolf is our technical producer. Heather Brandon is our digital editor. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. Thanks to Nate Gagnon and Dan Schultz. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.